is gonna have the news.
Monday, November 18th. It is not a holiday. Soak that in for a minute. It is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier here with Alyssa Walker and Hayes Davenport. Happy Sunday, guys. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. There's so much I'm excited to talk about this week. We got a lot of stuff.
This week, we have so many follow-ups of the like juiciest ongoing stories that we have.
Yeah.
And I'm super excited to get into it. What LA stories do you guys have first?
Alyssa, go ahead.
I got a peek at the future this week. I was at the Commotion Festival downtown. There was an autonomous scooter that my daughter saw and asked if it was a ghost.
No.
So, you know, the children can see the future. I got to interview a friend of the show, Senator Scott Wiener. That was really exciting. We got to do a little interview. Yeah, we got to talk about the future of SB 50 and the death of SB 127 and a bunch of other. I introduced him as like the legislator who, you know, created the most famous bill that did not become a law. And he's like, I passed 30 bills. You know,
prodigious bill writer.
Yeah, I was like, no, I don't mean it like that.
For listeners, SB 50, of course, is the upzoning bill that would have allowed for fourplexes statewide, basically anywhere that there is a single family home and like four or five story buildings near transit. SB 127, we talked about more recently, that was the Safe Streets bill, so-called, to force Caltrans to put in improvements for bike and pedestrian road users anytime that they were doing any kind of repaving work, basically. And
yeah, he was.
Both of those did
very,
not pass.
Yeah, very. Well, 50 still is coming back as a two-year bill, as I feel like I, you know, have to keep reminding people
it's
too.
On the shelf.
Even it's on the shelf. It's
next
on the,
to the elf.
It's on the elf on the shelf for.
Hide SB 50 and your kids run around the house and find it.
I feel like a Casey Kasem is
co-hosting. He seemed optimistic that it would, you know, the conversation and the process would continue in January. He was less kind about Caltrans. I was very...
And so you shut that down right away.
Yeah,
excuse me. We respect Caltrans at this house.
We were talking about the billions of dollars they spend on widening freeways in the state. But yeah, it was great when I asked about SB 127. He's like, yeah, that was a buzzkill. Like, proceeded to just talk about how irresponsible Caltrans has been. But he did seem optimistic by the new leadership, from the transportation leadership, and including like what we talked about before.
Did he say anything about Newsom with respect to 127? They have an interesting relationship where I feel like Newsom frequently calls out Scott Wiener for like praise. Like he singles him out in the legislature for praise a lot, but then he like vetoes his bills and is kind of like wishy-washy about other ones. It's weird.
I mean, he did say he thought the governor would make a statement or something about SB 50. So hopefully they're talking and they'll come to some kind of agreement. I think I could see why he should endorse it, especially since he's saying he wants to build all these units. This would be a good way. And he also praised...
No, he's saying he didn't say that.
Yeah, he's saying he didn't say that now. He walked that back. And he also praised SCAG, which I thought was really nice too. He gave a shout out to everybody here for showing up and getting those housing requirements upped on the coast. Coast to coast. Casey Kasem.
You had a... fantastic... Isn't Coast to Coast George Norrie? Like, isn't that paranormal show?
I think so. They're both no longer.
I think we should change the show to just
talking about the Area 51 raids. So you had a fantastic video of like the self-driving scooter. Oh, can you please explain that?
Well, that's what my daughter.
That is actually the future of transportation.
So there's this company, it's called Tortoise. They're meant to, I guess they could pick themselves up if they were tipped over and they could move them to a safer parking space, or they could rebalance it by moving a scooter. I don't know how far you'd go or how you would get there,
like
several blocks away maybe, to put it where people would want to ride it. And someone can just control it. There was somebody in Mexico City that was looking at a camera and like controlling it.
All this time, I've been really scared of those like Boston Dynamics videos. But
yes, this is scary.
Meanwhile, a scooter has just been following behind you everywhere you go. You turn around and it stops moving. God.
I just love that my daughter thought it was a ghost. It was so great. So scary. But I think it could have a benefit. I don't know. There was a bunch of wacky electric vehicles there that were some gimmicky, some probably good. So
you and I shared an LA story this week.
You did.
First of all, I have to apologize for saying George Norrie was dead. He is alive.
Casey Kasem alive?
Casey Kasem, I think that's an open question.
And now, back to the countdown.
That is for our listeners to answer.
But yeah, I'm sure we have a lot of Coast to Coast AM fans who probably listen to our show at the same time as Coast to Coast AM.
I was thinking American Top 40.
Those long haul truck routes. Yes. You've got LA podcast and you follow it with Coast to Coast AM.
So Alyssa alerted me to a Nextdoor thread. Anytime you go on Nextdoor and you see 180 replies to something, you know there's big trouble. And Alyssa sent me this thread about the Hoover, the encampment at the underpass at Hoover and Temple in kind of like South Silver Lake, historic Filipino town, Rampart Village adjacent area. That encampment is one that the group I work with, Sela, goes to a lot to provide services. We know a lot of people there. And it has also grown significantly in the last few months, and it's become one of the rougher encampments. There is a lot of drug use there. There was a cleanup. That was actually the place when I was talking about the Care Plus cleanup from a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It was there. And somebody posted a video of them driving through the underpass of this encampment. And they were like, this has gotten out of control. And there were a bunch of replies to that effect of varying sympathy. And what came out of this is a meeting at Cafecito Organico to talk about what to do about this. Mm-hmm. And so many, Alyssa was there, I was there. So many people from the city showed up. Like, I think three people from Mitch O'Farrell's office, three cops, someone from Laura Friedman's office.
Wow.
Who else? There were more. Someone from the mayor's office.
Mm-hmm.
That might be it. But it was a lot.
Who organized this meeting?
A neighbor.
Big turnout for that.
Yeah.
It was about matched by the number of...
Yeah, there were almost as many people from the city there as there were from people that were just neighbors. Yeah.
And I would consider, like, I don't live, like, immediately in that area. I was basically there for the same reason they were, to, like, talk about what's going on at the encampment. There were a number of interesting responses. I was struck by how sort of impotently the city defends itself. They say, like, we're doing cleanups and we're, like, trying to do this. But clearly some of the people there were just saying, actually, explicitly, someone were just saying, arrest them.
Yeah.
They were saying, crime is coming from these encampments. Yeah. So just arrest the people who live in them. In sort of like a Minority Report style pre-crime initiative that, like, arrest them before the crime is committed.
This is a very common strain of thought here in LA, like that there are crimes that happen specifically because the homeless are present. And if you just, like, disappeared the homeless, then there would not be crime.
Right.
And that's very, like, disturbing. I mean, my partner, Sarah, has been going out and canvassing, and she's talking to a lot of people who are, like, couching what they say about the homelessness in this language of, I care about the homeless people and they should be safe, except it's also, like, the end of that conversation is, can't we just, like, move them all somewhere very far away from me, and then everything would be fine.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the subtext and sometimes the text of these conversations. But the city people are just saying, we're working on it, we're doing cleanups, we're emptying the trash, whatever. But it wasn't really accounting for what a lot of the people there wanted, which was just to get rid of the encampments entirely. Yeah. And so finally, I tried to say at some point, like, it is now federal law that you cannot throw away these people's property. Mm-hmm. Like, you cannot sweep up their tents because there is nowhere else for them to go in this city. So the only way these encampments will go away is if we allow for more housing, more supportive housing, like with built-in services in this area. That is the only way out of this crisis, because otherwise, like, even if you did sweep up these areas, it would just move the problem around.
Yeah.
But they talk about, like, someone from the city attorney's office said it's not worth it to arrest them because juries won't convict them.
Yeah.
Juries will only see their sympathy for the condition that they were in on the street. And so they won't convict. And so we don't bother to go through the whole trial process, as if sort of implying that, like,
that's the problem.
That was an issue.
Yeah.
I think it was a good thing to say out loud, though, just juries for some of the angry people. I mean, I think I don't think that was exactly what he was trying.
Maybe that wasn't what he was trying to say.
I think he was trying to defuse the people who were angry and show that it would be a wasted effort to arrest them. Because some people were very angry at this
extremely
meeting.
Angry.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also mad at Caltrans.
How many people would you say were there?
I would say like neighbors,
in the community. Yeah.
I'm going to say 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that seem right? And again, like varying level, like yeah. everyone was sort of playing their role. There were the more sympathetic people. There was the guy with the dog who was wearing a Barstool Sports bandana that was very upset. And there was the guy who was like, guys, you know, we're all torn between our conflicting like values here or whatever. Here's the really crazy thing. Someone from Mitchell Farrell's office managed to contribute a new, you hear so many things about homelessness, these like standard cliches, very few of which are actually true. I managed to hear something new from someone in Mitchell Farrell's office at this meeting, which was, so at the, like, there's a few blocks away, there's an encampment like near Virgil on like Madison outside Path. And they put toilets.
There's porta potties, there's sinks, there's water, there's trash cans. They've added the services that you should have there. Yeah.
They probably
a guard posted
there. They have this whole setup there, and there's someone there who like maintains the facility, guards it, cleans it. And this person from Mitchell Farrell's office said that they thought the presence of that toilet had broken up that encampment and sent people to the Hoover encampment because they didn't want the quote oversight. So they left that encampment to come to Hoover.
Wow.
This is so patently ridiculous. It's first of all, that's
coming from a city council member's office.
A city council member who they were very driven to communicate that people don't want services. And then I had to say, we show up with a van and Sela and we open the door and people pile into this van to get services. Mm-hmm. They want services.
And this like that
I just want to clarify that why this is false. The Virgil encampment is still like on Madison is still huge.
Yeah.
It's enormous. People are using the sanitation facilities all the time. Why people might have left is because there's an enormous supportive housing building going up at Path.
Mm-hmm.
And so huge chunks of the sidewalk are no longer habitable.
Usable. Yeah.
So of course, I mean, like those tents had to go somewhere. Some of them might have gone to Hoover. The idea that people, so you hear, if you bring in services, more people who are homeless will come as a bad thing. But this was, if we bring in services, they will leave.
They'll scatter.
And they'll come to your neighborhood.
I've thought about this a lot that night, and I kept trying to think about like why that would be a narrative that would be productive. So I'm...
It disincentivizes services.
Right. So should we not be, they want us to not ask for services then?
Yes, correct. The answer is yes.
That was really troubling. And the other thing that I thought was worrying about what the response was from the city was they said they brought in trash cans, which they're these green, bright green trash cans, which is great. I mean, like you said at the meeting, what they really need is like Sharps containers. Like there's people at
the encampment have asked for.
Yeah, there's something that they've actually needles. Asked for. If they went and like asked for that, they would have given them that if they had actually asked. But they said that they were emptying the trash every day. And then that day, the trash had not been emptied. And it was already like, okay, if we know this is a small thing that you've done. It actually wasn't done. And it definitely hasn't been emptied every day. I don't go by there every day, but it's probably better now because it was getting a little bit better a few days ago. But the one thing that you were supposed to do was empty the trash. And that is basically the only thing I could see that they are doing there. And you probably know better than me, but and they said the reason that the delay had been in all these services is because of the fires.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So are we to think that just because it is a time of year where we know that there are fires, maybe the Barham fire that we were talking about last weekend. I mean, I just don't.
Which fire season is getting longer and longer.
I mean,
so
do we?
If the people picking up the trash have to go fight the fires.
I couldn't figure out that whole thing either. So that was another just troubling connection. Like, oh, well, actually, we won't pick up the trash when there's a fire or our service delay will be because of we are attending to something else. And like, this is actually the emergency. Mm-hmm.
And these do seem like you said, impotent defenses of like the city's response to issues around homelessness. But like, it also kind of seems like they are shifting any kind of agency or blame for the conditions on the street onto like, I don't know, the justice system and the people who are homeless themselves.
And also that we're supposed to somehow be paying attention to this is people in our neighborhood. So they're like, oh, if the trash cans aren't empty, you have to let us know. That is not my job. And I'm not going to be walking around saying, hey, you know what? This hillside is falling down and there's people living on a hillside and they're literally falling down the mountain. I shouldn't have to do that. There should be people paying attention to what's going on in their own district.
And on the trash container thing, when I mentioned that, Rachel Rose Lucky from the Rampart Village Neighborhood Council, who was there, immediately spoke up and was like, we have some discretionary funding. We can help put up the funds for that. The city stands there in silence.
Would they have ever asked if it wasn't for this meeting? I mean, this is just, I don't know who is doing the outreach. I don't know who is walking around like we are in our neighborhoods and talking to people. I talk to some of these people every day. I talk to them on the taking my kids to school. I check it. You know, we're doing this job. And I don't know who else is doing it except for Hayes and his volunteers.
they cannot even mention the idea of service provision without undercutting it at the same time. They also talked about safe parking and how they're talking about a safe parking lot nearby, and they said like, we're doing one in Echo Park, presumably at the Edendale Library, and it's gonna have this and this in terms of services, and this is a good thing. And so I just mentioned, like, since you brought it up, like, we've been waiting for that safe parking lot to open for over a year, and every party involved is ready for it to go except for the city. And we keep hearing next week, next week, next week. Like, when is that actually going to happen? And they said, oh, we don't want to get into timelines on that.
Yeah. Like, no, because then how would they go to every community meeting and bring it up as something that's about to happen?
Yeah. Like, Scott, do you have any stories from this week? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling a lot better. Thank you. I hopefully have exhausted my allotment of a number of times I can be sick. And
get it all
we're
done.
We're very strict about that on the podcast.
I only have a certain number of sick days. No, last week's episode was great. I loved Rachel and Haley guest hosting, so shout out to them. For me, I went to we had a friend staying with us this weekend from out of town. So we did some fun things you do when out of town folks come in. We went and saw a gallery opening downtown at Super Chief Gallery over by the Arts District last night, which was fun. I seldom stay out very late these days, so it was like a minor coup, I felt like. But I hadn't been over in that area of downtown in a while, and it was just kind of remarkable to me how much it feels like it has changed. Like, you know, it's still right there on 7th, directly adjacent, of course, to Skid Row, which is where the row gets its name from.
Where Commotion was.
Where Commotion was.
There's a helipad on there.
I actually hadn't been over there since the row opened, and it just feels so, it's like, I don't know, my opinion of the row going by there when it was closed, I think it was closed, is that it's just like, it's like if the Grove were a prison, basically.
And if the parking structure was twice the size of the Grove's parking structure.
It's like the
1/8 of the people.
It's like the Grove as like a panopticon. So I was like walking by, I was like, oh wow, this is interesting. It's a very strange vibe because it still is in a lot of ways the central area for our homelessness crisis. But then there is the gentrification in downtown has been going on for a long time. But now it really feels like the affluence is directly abutting some of the worst indigency in our region. And it's like kind
in
of
our
hard
planet
on our planet. Yeah, it's hard to even grapple with that mentally until you're like standing there and you're just like, oh wow, these are directly on top of each other now. So it was an interesting experience.
Let's get into what happened this week. There was going on right now, I guess, the California Dems convention in Long Beach. This is a pretty large affair. The vast majority of presidential candidates showed up. Biden and Warren, notably, were no-shows. There's an air of like chaotic frustration surrounding the whole thing. We actually talked about a while ago the election for Assembly Democrats, where you wait in line while people like physically beat you up with flyers.
Yeah, there are no anti-electioneering laws for the ADEM elections, which we all found out while we're
pro-electioneering laws. But they all go to this convention and they vote on things like a platform for different policies. And I heard a couple wild things. So in debating the platform, there was some debate over whether to support a Green New Deal in the platform. And they go back and forth on this for a long time. And the final resolution is, yes, support a Green New Deal, but make it decapitalized.
What? What does that mean?
So that means that we will not be able to fund anything.
It's not an uppercase Green New Deal. It's a lowercase Green New Deal.
Oh, capitalized.
Literally capitalized.
You meant like capitalism. Well, okay.
No, but I meant funding.
But what's the point of that?
It just takes it out of the realm of copyright and like it being an actual.
Well, then the city of LA should have done the same thing because they surely infringed on that copyright.
No, I think it takes it from a substantive project to more of like a theoretical framework. Like, yeah,
it already is a theoretical framework. It's not even
but they're trying to like disassociate it with the existing policy proposals that are, I suppose, concretely linked to certain candidates. Maybe that is the goal.
I mean, yeah, certain politicians like FDR, who, like, if you capitalize New Deal, then it becomes something associated with, like, the original New Deal. And this is just...
You mean, like, AOC?
Yeah, exactly. And
lowercase New Deal.
A lowercase New Deal is just a deal that is new. And it also happens to be green.
That's so dumb.
That is fantastic.
That's so dem, I mean.
Lou Dobbs. Now we're Lou Dobbs.
I feel like... And what I was getting from the CA Dem, like everything on Twitter about CA Dems, it's just there's like an anarchic spirit where it's just like all these like factions of people. It's like the world's largest Stan convention where just like people show up and they're like losing their minds Beatlemania style for Bernie or like doing choreographed Pete Buttigieg dances.
It is like a big Lord of the Rings battle where like two groups are like fighting it out and then the Klobuchar horde comes over the hillside. Yeah. And like
Battle of the Five Armies.
Yeah. So there was also a motion put forward to say that we would move toward a ban on internal combustion engines, not cars, but gas engines, move toward a ban. Guess what happened to that motion?
Capitalism.
It was shit gas. Very
capitalized internal combustion engines. Abolish ICE. Wait, so what is this platform like? What becomes of this platform in particular?
It becomes the California Democratic Party platform.
Okay,
and what becomes of that? It goes up on the internet. But it's like theoretically the standard by which the party has to, you know, they
judge themselves by, or they promote themselves by this platform.
Yeah, and it's legitimate in that a lot of the interests who are putting together this platform are also, Alyssa's grimacing at my cat, destroying my couch. Please, we're far past that at this point.
I'm just impressed.
Like the people putting together this platform are very powerful in California politics. Sure. The guy who went to CA Dems now is Rusty Hicks, who's like the most powerful labor leader in the state.
Yep.
And so if you can get the Democratic Party to sign off on this stuff, then it is more likely to happen in actual legislation. But it is hard in some cases to get that sign off to happen. Alyssa, you wrote a lovely piece about street vendors this week. Would you
like to
talk about that?
Well, yeah, it was something I was just thinking about the other day when I was walking home from the train and it was getting darker earlier. And there's two ways I can walk home. And one way, there's nobody and there's no lights on the sidewalk and there's a neglected bus stop and there, you know what LA looks like. And then on the other path, there's like a taco guy and a pupusa table outside of a church. And so I always walk that way, especially at night, because there's lights and there's people and smells good and you can get food. So I was just thinking about the role that street vendors play in like helping our cities feel not just, we hear a lot about like vibrancy and, you know, adding, you know, foot traffic, but just really at night, like it's safety, especially for a woman walking alone from the train. I feel very safe knowing that there are people out, and the city has done nothing to invest in making me feel safe. It's these, you know, vendors who also were only recently made legal to even be there in the city. And then what happened in New York last week, which was really troubling, which was a woman who sells churros in a subway. She was in a subway station, got handcuffed, got her cart taken away from her. And then another woman was actually arrested the next day for doing like the same thing. So they have this, they've hired what, like 500 more.
Yeah. I don't cops on MTA. Exactly. It is 500 cops to enforce like fare evasion and stuff. Evasion. Every single day there seems to be a new video put up of the cops like abusing a member of the public. It feels like
protest about that one. Yeah. The one that they have the day like before.
Bill de Blasio has been on a negative press tour since returning from his presidential campaign.
Yeah, he said the worst thing, which is what really got me angry, was that they make it about anytime anybody doesn't want a street vendor there, they always make it about safety. This happens in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard, where they say it's not safe for them to be there because there's too many people.
Yeah,
so then close the street. And then de Blasio said the same thing. It's not safe, it's creating congestion.
Yeah,
and that's a fine thing for him to say.
Congestion.
Person, Captain Congestion there in New York City. But I just wanted to remind people what the service these people are providing, and that police often are not the ones making streets feel safer, obviously, and subway stations and bus stops, and that there's a real disconnect between like what these people are doing who are selling and being on our sidewalks, and that the city should actually be paying them to be there. They shouldn't have to get these expensive permits just to be there, right?
That's something that I think is important that you pointed out. Like we think of now street vending is legalized, but in the process of legalization, now you have to pay these fees to do it.
Right.
Permits to just put a very small cart on the sidewalk. The margins for this business are not huge.
Right.
And so in many cases, they'll just prefer not to pay the fee. And also the places where it's most advantageous to sell your product, where there are a bunch of drunk people pouring out of a stadium, for example, who want to eat hot dogs, that they, for the most part, are not allowed to sell there.
They're banned from all the biggest traffic areas.
But enforcement is different in the different places. So the city banned it outside basically all the big arenas. And outside the Coliseum, I believe it is enforced out to like a certain radius. But outside the Chargers, like Dignity Health Stadium or whatever, they can sell.
Yeah.
It's just like nobody stops them. And outside Staples, people are still there. So that's good, but they are not out of the dark yet in terms of like enforcement.
And we do have a better
go ahead.
I was just going to compare us to New York. We have a better situation than in New York, where they haven't raised the number of permits since the 80s, which means that the permits are getting traded like taxi medallions on this black market. So you have a bunch of like very powerful street vendor men who have almost all the permits. And that's why a woman selling churros, for example,
isn't protected.
She can't even, she should never get one. They go for like thousands of dollars, a $200 permit. So at least our system maybe has a greater level of access for people, and hopefully isn't too high of a bar for people to be able to get that permit and do it the right way. But you're right. I mean, this is just, it's ridiculous that we are still making these laws about just a basic service that is critical to our streets.
The city's understanding of vending is like you said, is very backwards. There's not much appreciation for the fact that people who are vending, who are actually selling food and other goods, are like a useful part of whatever ecosystem they belong to, whatever public space that they're operating in. They are, by nature of being there, helping to make it a like safe and desirable place to be. There isn't an appreciation of that from the city, who kind of views it as, okay, we're going to give you the permission to do this if you pay us, but like not that you are performing a de facto good for everybody who is a user of that space. Like I've talked about before on here, or at least on Twitter, the vending that occurs on the red and the blue lines. You know, there's like especially the blue line, there is a vibrant marketplace there that is entirely illegal. And Metro actually plays announcements like every 50 feet telling you not to pay these people and that they shouldn't be there. But
they do provide a service. When the incense salesman comes on the train, it's immediately a better train to be on than it was before.
Yeah, someone threw up on the
screen. absolutely. And also, I mean, it goes without saying, like, I don't want to put too much responsibility on these people, but I think that by virtue of being in these spaces, they have an interest in making sure that it's a safe place to be. Like, I'm not saying like they are It's not like fucking Spider-Man on the train and Spider-Man 2 or whatever, but it is the case that they can't really sell things if there are no people there, you know? So it's a mutually supportive relationship, and people should be grateful that there are vendors in public places. Yes. I am.
There's a phenomenon. This is actually just one anecdote, but have you seen the brick oven pizza vendor on Sunset and Rampart? I think basically there's like instead of like a taco stand, there is a brick oven and they make fancy pizza.
Oh,
there.
I know you're talking about by the recycling center right there.
It's by where the bagel truck is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on Sunset by the liquor store.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's cool. Like brick oven pizza stand. But then it made me think like, oh, is this the result of giving out permits for this? So vendors are now like slightly more upmarket, where like they can pay for these permits in the same way that like when they legalize weed, like who got into that business? And one of the people that works at that pizza stand lives under the Alvarado underpass. And we picked him up and he was like, oh, come by. I cut the pizzas. I'll hook you up.
See? Providing services. We should provide them services.
Yep. Let's talk about some labor stuff. We got into, Scott, while you were gone, what happened at the Marciano Art Foundation. That story is ongoing. 70-something staff members laid off from this museum, this nonprofit museum, very abruptly after they tried to unionize. What is going on this week?
So there have been a number of protests. The laid off staff members staged a protest the following day. They said, we're going to work anyway. They went to the Art Foundation, even though they had been laid off, saying basically that the layoffs were retaliatory, that they were taking place because of the unionization effort, which is, of course, illegal. So there is going to be a labor complaint filed if it has not been already. The Marciano Art Foundation, which has said that it closed due to like poor performance. As you guys covered last week, they canceled their ongoing exhibition.
And the free museum, by the way.
The free museum said that there was not enough attendance to justify staying open.
So it was very poorly marketed as well. I didn't like talk about this, but you never see like the level of marketing, like for the Broad, when the Broad launched, it was everywhere. I never see promotion for the Marciano.
Carolina Miranda for the LA Times, who has been on our show before, has been covering this extremely well. And I think she had the best take on this that I've seen so far, which is, are these museums that are opening actually interested in being the social good that they are telling the rest of us that they want to be? Are they really interested in doing that? Or is this just a con, basically?
A tax haven.
Yeah, and that was my initial read on the situation, too, that the Marciano brothers, who are multimillionaires, of course, owners of Guess Jeans, were putting all of the art that they've bought over the years into a tax-free museum where they could pretend that they care about public access to these works of art, but are really just trying to, like, you know, get themselves a nice little tax deal.
Yeah.
And as soon as that was challenged in any way, they just decided to close. The laid off workers, the new news this week is that they are also going after Olivia Marciano, who is a board member at LAX Art. Is that correct? And they're pressuring Olivia Marciano to reopen the Art Foundation and rehire all of the workers who were laid off and allow them to continue their unionization drive. But there is now pressure that extends beyond just the two Marciano brothers and is going into other parts of the LA art ecosystem, trying to get the art community to say, this is not acceptable behavior. It's probably illegal, very likely illegal. And also there should be a strong condemnation from the art community. So I think that we're going to probably see this develop very rapidly, but it is, I think it's just interesting to note that like the Marciano brothers are big time Trump supporters. They're like, you know, it's like the kind of thing where it's like, there is a lot happening here contextually that would make you think they just didn't want a union in their workplace.
And they've been outspoken against unionization for every other business operation that they've had historically. So could maybe it's not a coincidence. You can follow what the Marciano Union is up to at MAF_Union. They're going to be marching a lot. They wear all black. So show up with them and look cool with because they're all cool art people. And other labor news, we sort of try to keep this day out of Hollywood industry biz news on this podcast, but this is something that really is a city story. Hollywood assistants they've had enough.
Yeah.
This is a job that is historically extremely underpaid. You get minimum wage. You work incredibly long hours. And if you get paid any overtime at all, you're lucky. Mm-hmm. You have to pay for a lot of your supplies, for your gas. And if you spend basically all day listening on the phone to the most horrible conversations you can imagine. I mean, we talk about and this is worse, but the workers in Indonesia and the Philippines that have to look through Facebook posts and sign off on them. The things that these assistants are forced to listen to all day. It's an incredibly noxious job to have. And the reality, the reason people do it is because it is seen as a stepping stone to the next level, partially by displaying loyalty and not ratting on your boss for the most
being a terrible person.
Yes, incredibly disgusting thing you heard them or their client say. They are finally stepping up. The movement is called hashtag pay up Hollywood. The hashtag is very active and they've put together a few surveys of Hollywood assistants to get a sense of what their lives are like. The mean average salary is $3,759 a month, which comes out to $45,000 a year or something for this incredibly time consuming job. It's guaranteed to be over 40 hours a week. You often have to spend time working as an unpaid intern before you get this job. So price that into what you're making off of it. It also has this effect of encouraging only people that have other sources of income to do it.
Absolutely. I mean,
that's what you find in this industry. So people who can better afford to be tortured.
And if that is the requirement entry level, you said, in order to get to the next stage of your career, you have to be able to go through this. You're immediately sorting out everybody who doesn't have that kind of income security to fall back on.
Yes. There are stories in the LA Times article by Stacey Perman from a couple weeks ago. One woman tells a story of when she was an assistant. She got a letter from the network's accountant saying that she had gone over the allotted lunch budget and the difference was going to be deducted from her paycheck. And that's probably the lunch budget for the entire staff, which they're charged with taking care of. And she made at that time $600 a week. I could tell you a story about why the industry is freaking out related to assistant stuff. There's a case going through, I guess, that makes it seem like assistants are going to be able to sue based on what they hear on these phone calls.
Yeah.
So if they hear something that is a violation of just basic HR conditions, they should be able to sue based on that. Sue their boss for putting them in the position to hear this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not an option to control what people say on these calls. So the route that most of the bosses are taking is cutting the assistants off from being on the phone.
You know what is amazing to me is that we are in a position where I think the closest analog to this, you're right that we don't talk about Hollywood too much, but since this is such a clear labor and workers' rights issue, I think it's well within our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
The closest analog is the conditions for the staffers of politicians. And if you had told me a couple of years ago, when Me Too first started happening, when people started speaking out about the conduct in these two arenas in particular, politics and Hollywood, if you would have told me that the House of Representatives and federal legislatures, the state and federal legislatures would address these kind of basic HR conditions for workers before Hollywood, before it was addressed for Hollywood, I would have been very surprised. But that's what's happened. And Hollywood remains, like you said, it's viewed as completely unrealistic that that somebody in a position of power would just not use harassing language or be completely what would be considered inappropriate in any other workplace. That's not considered an option. What they want to do instead is shut down the power of their powerless assistants. Yes.
Who take these jobs so they can learn.
Yeah.
That's why they still want to be on the phone for these horrible conversations, because then they can understand the business better. But now they're cut off from that. But it's totally,
Pete, there's this freak out now about like, oh, like Me Too is like taking everyone down. They're casting like such a wide net. Oh, buddy. It's like the tiniest, tiniest little fraction because yeah. of this culture right. where people are still afraid. And for all the like theoretical protections that are put in place when they report, their odds at getting promoted and rising to the top are significantly damaged
right.
by reporting still. And so the only way mm-hmm. for them to achieve some kind of power is through a movement like this. And it's incredible that it's happening and people are very scared. Let's go back to homeless housing a bit. There was a motion put forward in the city council this week that I thought was very interesting. This is from David Rue, Joe Bustaino, and Marquise Harris Dawson. This is a state of emergency motion. They said FEMA level response on homelessness.
Didn't we yeah. already do this though?
Yes, we
or didn't
like,
we say we
did.
Said we were gonna do it, then we didn't actually do
it. That is correct. It never happened.
So it never happened.
Yeah, it never actually okay, so this is for real though.
This is for real
emergency.
This is an emergency. It's FEMA time.
Alyssa's air raid sirens are playing in the background.
No more business as usual.
We can finally empty the trash cans.
Oh no.
The city council is taking charge and saying we have to do something about homelessness. What are we going to do about it? We are going to abdicate all of our powers to the mayor
yeah.
and let the mayor get the blame for building homeless housing. That is what this motion says. It says the city council will give up its responsibility for building homeless housing and put it all in the hands of the mayor's office. So the mayor will get to choose the sites, like give out the permits to different like contractors and things like that. Just saying, here you go. Like this is an emergency. You take care of it. Does the mayor want this?
This is
power?
So interesting. Like this is the most interesting response to this I can think of because it does the immediate extension of this motion is we are the problem. We, the council members, are the problem. We cannot be expected to follow through on our responsibility to get these individuals, or like not even to get them across the finish line, but not to impede the siting of homeless housing. You yep. cannot rely on council members to do that. We have to give up all say. That's the only way that these projects will be allowed to be built is if we just give that power to someone else. This is an area where LA's mayoral system, which is extremely weak by comparison to other major American cities, has created this balance of power where the city council can step in and stop the administration of the city such that homeless housing will not be put in place. They're basically saying we need a stronger mayor so that we don't get tempted to stop this.
Instead of just saying, let's build it ourselves, let's use this immense power that we have to do this, they want to pass it off to someone who I do not believe wants this responsibility.
No.
And the thing that's interesting, like you can track on, there's a supportive housing tracker for every council district on everyoneinla.org. And it shows you in each of the districts how mm-hmm. much supportive housing each of the council members has built. And some of them are getting it done. Mike Bonin, friend of the show, has a upper income, one of the wealthiest district in the city. There were only 63 supportive housing units before the last 2 years. He has approved 382 more units. That's a lot for yeah. District 11. Jose Huizar, while he's been busy with so many other things, they already had 2,956 supportive housing units in his district. It's downtown, so mm-hmm. Skid Row. It's mm-hmm. in that area. He still approved 1,000 more. Which is in each district committed to building 222 units, approving yeah. 222 units. So some of them are doing this.
Where are our three amigos at?
Our three amigos, Joe Buscaino is over his approval, 291 out of 222. Okay. Marquise Harris Dawson is way over. He's approved 729 units.
Nice.
David Rue is still not quite there yet. He's approved 167. And District 4 had the fewest number of units going in. They only had 54. But some of them, like Gil Cedillo, has more than doubled the number of mm-hmm. of units in his district. Some of them are doing this.
Yep.
And so the idea that you need to give up these powers to another office, like it is happening. Bob Blumenfield is not doing it. He's only approved 54 units.
Right.
John Lee has approved 63 units that he tried to get canceled. Those are approved despite him.
Right.
Mitch O'Farrell, 669 new units in his district, more than double that were there previously. So it is happening. Why can't we look at some of the council districts that are getting this accomplished?
The divide between the valley and the city is interesting.
It's significant.
In this case. I think
but also Paul Koretz, who is theoretically part of the city of Los Angeles, has only approved 99 units out of the 222. Yeah. He's unlikely to meet the goal.
But also the goals are so low.
So low. Not even close to enough.
It's nothing. Yeah, it's not even what we need.
You have to explode past it the way someone like Jose Huizar or even like Mitch O'Farrell has to come even close to keeping up with the demand.
Right. Has Garcetti responded to this publicly?
He's probably out of town.
I think he was. Well, I think he's a law group. I think he's probably. I know he's at the CAA.
Oh, he's at the Dems.
I mean, if only there were like an eco-friendly way he could communicate remotely with. I don't know.
But I mean, the other thing that I will say, over the last week, a lot of really amazing housing projects have opened, and the mayor has been in all of them. It's been really good to see. There was a big development by the Expo Line. If you go like just south of the Expo Line, the Vermont Expo Station right by Expo Park, huge mixed use, family supportive housing project. Some really beautiful new things have opened. We feel like we're making a lot of progress. Like a business owner down by the river just offered up his building to turn it into bridge housing. Like people are stepping up with this idea that we're tapping kind of every avenue necessary to create the housing is great. But there has to be, and maybe the mayor is this person. I don't know. If it's somebody who is saying we can't say no, where was he during like the John Lee battles or something like that? Right. So
right.
Where he was, are we still going to let these people run their little kingdoms all over the city? If it's not him, who is it going to be? And I don't know.
It shouldn't be an elected official. Why is it someone who has to be scared about re-election? Like appoint a commission.
But that's why the mayor is perfect, because he doesn't have to be scared about re-election.
Okay, but I mean, I think that
re-election, sorry, to a different office.
And Garcetti has shown that he will take that into consideration and totally change his support for projects or bills based on who is going to be funding his next election. So that is a concern. But I do think, you know, so having the mayor have this authority, I think, is not necessarily de facto a bad thing. I think potentially it could be much better than having city council have this authority,
right,
specifically because the mayor can delegate it to an unelected official. He can, as has happened other places, have, you know, an office specific to the response to the homelessness crisis, or, you know, like homelessness czar or whatever, which I think we may already have. But having that individual have the ability to make these decisions without having to have it become a referendum on one politician's future career, I guess, is a probably much more sustainable way than what the current setup is. But saying that we're only going to do this because it's an emergency, I don't know.
It's
like
just it, now an emergency.
Yeah, right. When did that happen? But I am kind of curious about that aspect of it, where it's like when we are no longer in a state of emergency, doesn't appear to be anytime soon that this will no longer be an emergency, but then we go back to the status quo, I guess. I don't know.
I actually disagree with even putting it in the mayor's office, because I mean, it's like saying when Obama was president or whatever, we'd be like, oh, let's put the authority to do some beneficial thing in the office of the president. Like the mayor changes, and I don't want authority over something as important as providing a foundational resource for life in this office that like Richard Reardon was in not that long ago. I mean, we've had Republican right. mayors. These things that like come in waves or whatever, like appoint a commission, give it to HOCLA, the housing authority of the city, give it to HCID, the community investment department or whatever, like groups that are not as closely tied to elected officials.
But the commissions, like we have a ton of those
They just created a new one. I mean, we have multiple bodies that could be.
And
there are,
somebody has to appoint
decisions.
The commissioners. Generally, it's the mayor.
Sure.
And then you end up with what I think happens with the commissions is you end up with exactly the situation that you're describing, where the body is sort of representative of the aegis of whoever puts them in power, with the mayor who changes, except in a less like clear and accountable way to the public. Like, there's not an
That's
office.
True. You know, and it's often like a political appointment, and the people put in charge have no idea what they're doing.
And they're just like lawyers or whatever.
But there is a way. I mean, like, we talk about like a public bank being a good idea, but I don't want the council members having oversight over the public bank. Like, there has to be a way.
Can you imagine?
What if we?
I mean, it's basically what we have.
What if we replace the council members with different people?
Well, that there's an idea.
That's kind of what they're pushing for. They're basically saying, we can't do
it. We can't do this.
We are
not equipped for this job.
What's so fascinating about it is they want control over everything.
Yeah.
Like the idea of them giving up responsibility, like permitting over every lot in the city, weed licenses, total discretion over individual weed licenses. Give me that.
Which has been an issue already in the clearest possible way, because you have the council members controlling a very limited supply, like we were talking about in New York, the vending licenses.
Yes.
Here we have the cannabis vending licenses being in extremely artificially limited supply, giving council members this incredible power to raise up their friends and strike down their enemies. And then, of course, now this is like the most in-demand post-retirement job for politicians is to go be a cannabis board member or whatever. So the tendency to corruption is clear. And I think that you want to remove the council members from positions like these where the ethical implications are that they will make bad decisions that are like good for themselves and bad for the public interest.
Yeah, and if they don't want control over it, like homeless housing, that can only mean that it is a pure good.
Right. There's nothing to be gained from it. There's only benefit for the public. And then somebody else, please do this instead of us.
A couple little stories. Did you see the body part harvesting story?
What is that?
This is so wild. I had missed this, too. This is from October 13th in the LA Times. I just completely missed it. At the coroner's office, there are, like, when a body comes to the coroner's office pending a death investigation because of uncertainty over the circumstances of the death, could be a homicide or whatever, frequently now, the coroners go to perform the autopsy and enormous pieces of the body are missing because groups, human tissue procurement companies, there's one called One Legacy that they refer to specifically, are legally allowed to go in and get the parts. So there's a story, a lead of this story by Melody Peterson talks about a woman who died in her home and they were concerned about possible abuse. And when the coroner's investigator went to examine the body, the bones from her legs and arms were gone.
Oh, my God.
And large patches of skin from her back also gone. And you think like, oh, this is maybe for like donation, like organ donor stuff. But often it's for selling to research companies and like biotech. You can like, there's a biotech market where quote, a half teaspoon of ground up human skin is priced at $434 because it's used as a lip and butt plumper.
Ground up human skin.
And I also read a while ago, they're working on 3D printing organs.
Uh-huh.
And what they use for that is foreskins from babies, like from the hospital, which that seems great. Got to do something with
those. Yeah, you got to recycle those.
Foreskins. Yeah.
That sounds like white nationalist propaganda.
A single body can supply raw materials for products that sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Uh-huh.
That makes me feel very valuable.
Yeah, sure.
Just walking down the street. That story was wild. Also, there was a big DACA protest march this week. Hundreds and hundreds of students left school during the Supreme Court hearing to rule on whether Dreamers would continue to be protected. According to Mike Viewer's office, guess what percent of Dreamers live in Los Angeles?
25.
Only 13, but still a ton.
Yeah, a lot. And also, I mean, the Supreme Court hearing, which did happen this past week, it seems like there is probably a conservative majority that is going to overturn protections for or allow Trump to cancel the DACA program. So
yes, and this will threaten so many children in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles,
as TPS, temporary protected status, is also being threatened for thousands and thousands of Salvadorans in Los Angeles who have been here for decades. This is an issue that is talked about nationally, but is most significant here.
Yeah, and this DACA is a program that has allowed children who immigrated to the U.S. When they were young to plan for their futures here. This is a program that has allowed them to have a semblance of stability and normalcy. You know, when Trump was first elected, there was a, you know, there was this fear among the immigrant community that they had trusted the government. This is a good example of what we were just talking about with the mayor. You know, the mayor changes, the president changes. People had trusted the American presidency with their information, yes, despite their vulnerability to deportation, under the promise that they were not going to be deported to somewhere that they had never really known or lived. Enter Donald Trump, and now the American government has all of the information about them, where they live, who they live with, etc., and that they are in the country,
yep,
not having gone through the legal immigration process. And so when or if the Supreme Court comes back and says that DACA can be canceled at any time by President Trump, now we have a ton of Angeleno children and young adults who have built their lives on the basis of thinking that they were in safe hands with the American government and are likely to be betrayed in that trust. And what does LA do about that? Like, where is the political leadership saying, like, we have a responsibility? You know, like, it's like the Paris Accords or mm-hmm. whatever, where we've said we have a responsibility to our planet that is still our responsibility, even if the federal government tries to.
There's been some from the state. Advocate it. The state leadership has been good on this, mm-hmm. but locally,
we need it locally.
Yeah.
We need it locally, and you know, like you imagine that the avenues for reproach are somewhat limited, but do something, yeah, right? Like you got to do something.
We also want to talk about, there's a horrible story this week in Santa Clarita, a school shooting at Saugus High School. Two children were killed, Dominic Blackwell and Gracie Ann Muehlberger. Three other students were injured. I was trying to think about how to talk about this and sort of realized that I didn't know too much about Santa Clarita. We tend to be sort of a city-centric podcast, even like basic, basin-centric.
And basic.
Yeah, we are a little bit
more basic.
We can admit that. I was reading about Santa Clarita. I learned a lot of history that I think we don't have time to share now. But it is an upper income area. I think people who live in LA think of this as the rich area and the valley and like the Northern Valley as being poorer. But Santa Clarita has a higher average median income than Hancock Park, yeah, one of the richest neighborhoods in our city, because it's like primarily homeowners and things like that. But their schools for the last decade have really suffered. The elementary school district, Saugus Union District in Santa Clarita, has the second lowest per student funding of any school district in LA County. Guess how many school districts there are in LA County?
80.
That is exactly correct. Was that?
You just like took number of cities minus 8 and then you were like 80.
So since 2012, in 2012, they had a student-teacher ratio for elementary schools of 20 to 1, and it's now 30 to 1.
Eek.
In just a few years. In Hart Union High School District, where Saugus High is, they have a pretty large population of English language learners. And in 2013, they reported that they, because of budget issues, they were offering no services to learn English to 1,142 students.
Oh my God.
English language learners who are, it's state mandated that you have to, but they don't have they feel like they don't have the funds to provide these services for over half of their English language learners. And they also, in the last decade, have been increasingly terrorized by fires, the Tick Fire, most mm-hmm. recently the Rye Fire a couple years ago, which went right up against Magic Mountain. And today, Sunday, they have the highest fire risk in Southern California. They have there's a red flag warning today, critical fire risk. So this is a city that has been like in this very volatile place and like sort of uprooted a lot over the last few years. School getting canceled all the time because of air quality and fires and things like that. And so it's horrible that they have to go through something like this in their community now.
Also the high school of former Rep. Katie Hill.
Yes.
And we just had the announcement of when the election will be scheduled
for. Right, yeah. So Katie Hill, of course, left Congress recently due to the sharing of revenge porn by her soon-to-be ex-husband. The date for her for the special election to replace her in District 25 is going to be the same day as the primary election, March 3rd of next year. So we'll cover that more as it gets closer. We do have also an announcement of a new candidate for that seat. We had talked previously about George Papadopoulos, coffee boy.
Christy Smith. Assemblywoman Christy Smith.
And then Steve Knight himself is who was previously the rep for that district before being beaten soundly by Katie Hill. And hopefully we'll lose soundly again. And now we have the new entrant, who is Cenk
Uygur
from the Young Turks.
Host of the Young Turks.
Also a, I believe, founding member of the Justice Democrats Coalition. Is that correct?
I think so.
Were responsible for getting representatives like AOC and Ro Khanna into Congress. This being like one of the more liberal wings of the party. But that is creating some internal strife within the Democratic Party, specifically because Christy Smith is, I guess, close to Katie Hill. And Katie Hill gave her endorsement. A whole host of Democratic electeds did as well. So now we have something of a contest on our hands, I guess.
Also, Mike Cernovich, alt-right celebrity, is talking about getting into the race as well. And all of this will bring attention to Santa Clarita that I would say they, and that region, that they don't necessarily want. It's an area that always, I think, has kind of existed as an alternative to the city of LA. I found a quote from a news publisher there, a guy named Scott Newhall, part of the Newhall family that founded the whole region, who he called LA City the greatest aggregation of sneak thieves, rapists, child molesters, armed robbers, and phantom flashers ever gathered in one place in the long history of mankind. But that has kind of been the Santa Clarita, like, come to Santa Clarita where it's like safer and like it's like more of a quiet community.
It's a law and order community, yes, in the sense that like this is where the cops live. Basically, right?
Yeah. And it's a brand new city still. It only became a city in 1987.
Uh-huh.
It was a collection of unincorporated neighborhoods, but now in many ways, most of them unpleasant. They have had like they've been subjected to like one crisis after another, and it's something that they do not deserve. Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. We will be back next week to talk about more stuff. Bye.
LA Podcast. LA Podcast. LA Podcast gonna have